In this class, I hope to deal with two rare and controversial works from the Rishayim. One is called Malmud HaTalmidim. It was written by Rabbi Yaakov Antuli. The other one is called Viat Chin. It was written by Rabbi Levi Ben Avram. Both of these works played a large role in the famous controversy against learning philosophy led by Rabbi Abba Mari and the Rajba, which took place between the years 1303 and 1305 in Provence, southern France. A while back, I was researching the development of the minhag of saying a drasha at a wedding. One point which I found was that one of the issues which sparked off the controversy against learning philosophy were certain svarim full of problematic ideas were being read as the drasha at the weddings. The sefer which was being read at the wedding was the Malmud HaTalmidim, Rabbi Yaakov Antuli's work. In this class, I hope to give an overview of this controversy with the background of its authors. I also hope to discuss a few other interesting things about these works not related to the controversy. Rabbi Yaakov Antuli was born around 1194 in Provence, southern France. Rabbi Yaakov Antuli married a daughter of Rabbi Shmuel ben Tibbon. There was a possibility he was related to him in an additional way. Rabbi Shmuel ben Tibbon was his main teacher in philosophy and mathematics. Shmuel ben Tibbon was the son of Rabbi Yehuda ben Tibbon. The question is, who was Rabbi Shmuel ben Tibbon or Rabbi Yehuda ben Tibbon? Tibbon was known as the father of translators. He translated many classics from the original Arabic into Hebrew. Among them, the Tikkun Nefesh of Ibn Gabriel, Kuzari, Mifkar Pninim, Amun of Adeus of the Rasag, and some works of Ramina Ibn Janach. Rabbi Yehuda Ibn Tibbon also translated the Chovos HaLevavos at the request of Rabbi Meshulam Yilonil and the Ravid. Rabbi Yehuda Ibn Tibbon was born in 1120 in Spain, but he moved later on to Lonil, which is in southern France. Not much is known about him, but from a work of his called Bideres HaMusar, which is an ethical will recently reprinted, we can learn a little bit about him. He wrote this will to his son Shmuel ben Tibbon. We see in this will, he was a doctor, he was close to the Baal Amar. He writes how the Baal Amar, who was the Galal Adar of the time, used to show him his writings before he sent it out. He also loved his only son, Rabbi Shmuel ben Tibbon, very much, and wanted him to succeed as a doctor and translator of Svarim. In this will, he advises his son to study medicine and other chachmas. Rabbi Yehuda is very concerned throughout the will that his son, Rabbi Shmuel, learn how to write clearly and grammatically correct, giving him many tips on how to do so. He tells him to make sure to learn Arabic, and by learning the parasha every week in Arabic, it will help him learn the language. As an aside, this will is very interesting in regard to collecting svarim in libraries, but that's a different topic. What seems to be very clear is that Shmuel ben Tibbon listened to his father's advice, and he too became an expert translator and philosopher. He authored a philosophical work called Maimer Yukava Amayim and a Perush on Kehelis, which was a manuscript until recently, when James Robinson printed it as his doctorate, and most recently in book form. The ethical will was printed recently in Yerushalayim. It's also found in the collection of Tzavos printed by Israel Abrams, that is also located on Hebrew books for easy reference. What Rabbi Shmuel ben Tibbon is most famous for is his translation of the Mar Nevuchim of the Rambam, which was originally written in Arabic. Rabbi Yonasan Melonil, one of the most important people of that era, who was in contact with the Rambam, requested of Rabbi Shmuel ben Tibbon to please translate this work. Rabbi Shmuel worked very hard on this translation and even was in contact with the Rambam about it. He wrote to the Rambam various questions and various concepts to explain him. He even asked the Rambam if he could come visit him to discuss the work. The Rambam replied to him in what is now known as a famous letter that, "Don't bother coming. I have a very difficult work schedule working for the Sultan, and he does not have time for anyone. The trip will be in vain." After reading this lengthy response from the Rambam, it's simply amazing to see how the Rambam was able to accomplish what he did with such a rough schedule. Anyways, in general, it's hard to be a translator, as one has to be able to understand the work one is working on, and be able to put those ideas into a similar, understandable language that one is translating it into. It's especially so in the case of the Mar Nevuchim, which was a very complicated work. What I'd like to stress today is that he was not only the first translator of the work, but he was its first commentator. Yosef Kapach, in his edition of Mar Nevuchim, dismisses the quality of Shmuel Ibn Tunin's translation and says that besides for not knowing Arabic well, he also did not understand the philosophical ideas of the Rambam. He claims he only started understanding philosophy much later on in life. He goes so far as to claim that that's why the Rambam did not want to meet with Ibn Tunin in person when he requested a meeting. He was basically pushing him off, as he was not impressed with the quality of the job which he saw. However, today we know that Kapach is completely wrong. First of all, Yitzhak Shiller has showed that one of Kapach's main reasons for saying this was because he did not have the whole correspondence of the letters between Ibn Tibbon and the Rambam. Today we do, and we see a careful reading of the documents show that this is not the case. The Rambam had no problem with Ibn Tibbon's translation, and he was not pushing him off. Furthermore, Carlos Frankel, in his doctorate and now recent book on Ibn Tibbon, shows based on over 100 manuscripts that Ibn Tibbon was a commentator, and he has many pieces explaining with a great understanding of philosophy the words of the Rambam. In short, he was a great philosopher and did understand the Rambam quite well when he was working on the translation. Surprisingly enough, Herbert Davidson, in his excellent work on the Rambam, was not aware of all this, and he seems to agree with Kapach. Anyway, this translation of Shmuel Ibn Tibbon was completed in 1204 and was the most used translation of the Mar Nevuchim, although there were other translations done. He was responsible for making the Meir so famous and accessible to most of the Jews throughout history. Returning to Yaakov Antuli, his father-in-law, Rav Shmuel, was the prime teacher of his in the field of philosophy. Rav Yaakov must have been very well known for his expertise in this field, as he left for Naples, Italy in around 1231. Because he was recruited by the Emperor Frederick II to join his court. He was hired there as a translator of philosophical works. Other sources show he was a medical doctor and practiced that too there. Frederick was very interested in intellectual pursuits, and Tully even quotes him in his Malmud Talmidim twice. Emperor Frederick also recruited the famous scientist and mathematician Michael Scott, with whom Rabbi Yaakov Antuli developed a very close relationship, as we will soon see. Indeed, while working on this in the court of Emperor Frederick, Antuli translated many works of philosophy. Rabbi Yaakov Antuli died in 1256. At some time after the death of his good friend Michael Scott, Rabbi Yaakov Antuli wrote up his Sefer Malmud HaTalmidim, and he completed it around 1249. The Sefer was sermons set up according to the parashas. Each one begins with a pasuk, usually from somewhere in Tanakh. He then deals with a topic or two of that week's parasha, answers up his problems based on philosophical ideas, either based on ideas that in the Mar Nevuchim, ideas he heard from his father-in-law, or sometimes himself. The Sefer is extremely well-written and full of beautiful ideas, some of which we'll see soon. Sometime after he wrote it, it started becoming very popular and remained very popular for a few hundred years, as we also soon see. Professor Tashma has an article trying to trace when exactly did the Rambam's work start having a heavy influence in Italy. It could be that Antuli's work helped start the influence on Italian Jewry, as it was heavily based on the Rambam and was written in Italy. Anyway, there was a controversy. In 1303, the famous controversy against learning philosophy began. Many of the actual letters of the controversy were printed by the main person involved in the controversy, Rav Abba Mari. He recruited one of the Gedolei HaDor of that time on his side, the Rajma. The collection of letters is called Minchas Kanois. A few years ago, a critical edition of this was put out by Chaim Dmitrovsky. From Meisner of Kup. Today, these volumes are very hard to find, although they were printed just a few years ago. Dmitrovsky's edition is excellent, but he promised a whole introduction on this controversy and has yet to be printed. Another important original text on this topic is called Chayshem Mishpat, written by one of the other Gedolim on Rav Abba Mari's side. It was printed from a manuscript over 100 years ago in the Sefer Tveres Seva, which was presented to Leopold Zunz, one of the fathers of modern-day Jewish Wissenschaft, on his 90th birthday. Besides for this, many studies have been written on this topic, each focusing on different points of the controversy. Just to mention one of them, it's called Ben Chachma L'Taira. It was written by Moshe Halbertal. This is the same Moshe Halbertal who just wrote an interesting article in the New Republic about the Goldstone Report. Just to give a quick overview of what happened. Gad Freudenthal, in an article on the topic, writes, in around 1303, Rav Abba Mari reached the conclusion that philosophy had penetrated too deeply into the world of his fellow Jews in southern France, particularly the younger generation, and that traditional learning was losing ground. He was particularly alarmed by the fact that extremist allegorical interpretations were expounded as a matter of course to the large, i.e., lay public notable on the occasion of Saturday services in the synagogue, at weddings and other special events. Looking for a way to put an end to what he regarded as a threat to the theological soundness, indeed the very existence of Judaism, he decided to urge the greatest leader of the time, the Rajba, to issue a ban on the study of philosophy at least before a certain age. In 1305... What? Can you hear that question? In 1305, on Tisha B'Av, it fell out on Shabbos, a chirim was issued by the Rajba and other Gedolim. One of the parts of the ban was that people should not learn philosophy before the age of 25. A careful reading of the Minchas Kanois shows that from the main svarim that sparked all controversy were the works of Rav Shmuel ibn Tivan and his son-in-law, the Maamon of Talmidim. In one place, Rav Abba Mari writes, Ki ishtadlisenu b'sina k'negeh bala malamed Rav Shmuel Tibben v'sifrei. Elsewhere, Rav Abba Mari writes, V'ruach hakina b'roisi k'tzas anashim yishar makaymois v'yitois hanesuim yidushu b'rabam b'batek nesiris. Here we see that it was being read in public at weddings. But it's not clear if he's referring to Yaakov and Tuli. In a different letter by one of the Gedolim on Rav Abba Mari's side, we find the Kara Na'im Divrei Sefer Hamalami Bebeis Alekim, the Darshim Boy Minatzarayim Ad Alois Hamincha VeRoiv Hakal VeOid Ma'at Shemim Divreim. That basically the Sefer Hamalami was being read day and night in front of all the people. We see from all this just how popular the Maamon of Talmidim was. In truth, just know quickly there were great gedolim against the chirim, most notably the Meiri, but most of what he wrote about this has not survived. Another person after the chirim was Rabbi Didya Pnini, who also wrote a whole defense on the Rajba. It is unclear if the Rajba came out again openly against Rav Antuli or not. There are some places in the documents which sound like he did, others sound like he did not. But another person who was attacked by the Rajba openly, Rav Abba Mari, was Rav Levi ben Avram. Rav Levi was born around 1250 in southern France, and according to Yisrael Davidson, was a nephew of the Sefer HaTamid. The Sefer HaTamid was the Rebbe of the Meiri. He wrote a massive encyclopedic work of mathematics and sciences called the Leviat Chaim, which he completed in around 1296. This work was composed of a few sections. One section was an in-depth explanation of many of the Agadat HaGemaras and a philosophical work about many of the mitzvahs. Many parts of this manuscript have survived. A few small parts were printed by Yisrael Davidson a while back. Recently, two massive volumes of this work were printed in critical editions by Chaim Kreisel, one by Magnus Press and one by University of Ben-Gurion. Now, this work is also mostly based on philosophy and it's full of allegorical interpretations of Tzairon Chazal. One of his main sources was the Maamon of Talmidim. Rav Levi was attacked by the Rajba. The Rajba wrote to people who were hounding him not to do so. The person at first ignored the Rajba. Then a child of his died. He took it as a sign to listen to the Rajba. Scholars have come up with all kinds of silly possibilities why the Rajba really went after Rav Levi, that he was poor and all other types of reasons. Today I will attempt to give a little better understanding to this controversy and why the Rajba went after Rav Levi. In order to understand the real reason why they went after Ablevi and the works of Herman Tumi, we must give a drop of background. What I'm suggesting here is based a little bit on the works of Yitzhak Heinemann, Ephraim Talmadge, and of Ram Halkin, with a bit of my own additions. There's a famous Chazal, Shivim Panim L'Torah, meaning there are 70 ways to interpret the Torah. One of the methods used to explain the Torah of Chazal is through allegorical interpretations. This means explain something based on the assumption that the author intended something other than what is literally expressed. However, those that use these methods were not saying that this is the only explanation. Rather, this is one way to interpret it. Of course, the simple meaning is true. Both the Malmud HaTalmidim and Levi HaTchein write this, that all they were offering was the interpretation, not the only interpretation. However, the fear of the Gedolim was that the masses would not differentiate and think that these explanations are the only ones. There was extra concern of the Rajban and others with these kinds of explanations when they were used to explain the reasons for mitzvahs. The fear was that people would use them, they would apply them halachically and start making up different leniencies based on these reasons. Now, what seems to have been the problem is these ideas were being taught to the masses. As we see, one of the Gedolim, Rav Abba Mari Sarg, writes, "The darshan by minat zarayim, ad alois mincha." The Roiva Kalva Oid Mat Shemaim Devrayim. It was in public. And elsewhere we see another Gala writes that it was Beitais and Esuin Vanois Apuritis Yidushu Berabim Bebatik Nasiyas. It was in public. According to this, we can understand why they're against these works. The Malmud HaTalmidim was being read publicly, and Levi HaTchein was intended to be an encyclopedia of all knowledge for the masses, especially based on allegorical teachings. Chaim was not learning philosophy in general, only until the age of 25. With this, we can perhaps understand some other issues that others raised. The Rajban himself used allegorical explanations in his Perush on Haggadah of Shas. As a matter of fact, he was heavily criticized by Rabbi Yosef Ashkenazi, who lived in the times of Arizal, for this. According to this explanation, we can understand the Rajban's usage of allegorical interpretations. As he was not against allegorical as a whole, rather he was just against it being used for the masses. Another point which we can understand with this is why was the Rajba so against allegorical interpretations? He wrote many interpretations in his work on Haggadah based on Kabbalah, which is also not literal translations. The answer is, as the Rajba was of the camp not to teach Kabbalah openly. So it was not a problem. The whole concern over here was these allegorical interpretations were being taught to the masses. One last point which you can possibly understand with this explanation is one of the main people we find used the work was Rabbi Shua ibn Shuib. Rabbi Shua ibn Shuib was a very big Talmud of the Rajba. So the question is, how could he, a big Talmud of the Rajba, go ahead and use the Sefer, which his Rebbe was very against? Now, to be sure, in history we have many instances of Talmidim using the works of their Rebbe, even though the Rebbe came out against it. One famous, often used example is the Mari Menayim. The Maral came out very strongly against it, but his Talmidim, the Taisus Yontif, and Rav Ganz both used it. But over here, we don't need to say that. The Rajba was not against the Sefer. He was against it being taught in public amongst the masses. Rabbi Shua ben Shuib was using it here and there for good ideas, but not teaching the whole Sefer in front of the masses. In around 1334, Rabbi Yerucham, a Talmud of the Rush, authored a work called Toldos Adam Mechava and Sefer Meshara. This work was first printed in 1517 and later again in 1513. What's rather strange about the Sefer is, although most Rishonim that we have today have been reprinted in many editions, retypeset with footnotes and everything, Rabbeinu Yerucham is the only Sefer which is constantly only photomechanically reproduced from the 1553 edition. The question is why? The answer might be found in the words of the Chidah in Shema Gedolah, where he brings from the Maggid of the Beis Yosef, the Maggid Meisharim, where the Maggid told the Beis Yosef some very harsh words about Rabbeinu Yerucham. In a different place, the Shema Gedolim writes that he heard from old Rabbanim, the city of Jerusalem, that they have a tradition that the book Sefer Iter and Sefer Rabbeinu Yeruchim are high secrets, and anyone who writes a commentary on these books, either the work will be lost or they will die in the prime of their life. He then goes on to list a few people who started working on expounding the Sefer and either died in the middle of the work or their work was lost. The Sefer Iter 2, we have the famous Litvish Gadol. His name was Rabbi Yaina. Slipping his last name right now. And this Rabbi Yaina, we know this Rabbi Yaina, we have testimony that he had major difficulty. He worked on printing a Perush on the Iter. It was printed, but he suffered many losses. Children he lost, and etc., etc. The question is, what did Rabbeinu Yeruchim do, which was so wrong to warrant such a curse? In a recent article on the topic, Yehuda Galinsky and James Robinson show that a piece of the introduction of Rabbeinu Yeruchim's work comes from Malma Talmidim. In truth, that piece comes from Michael Scott, as we mentioned, the friend of Malma Talmidim. This, they say, caused some opposition against the Sefer Rabbeinu Yeruchim, as we know, the Sefer HaMalmud was banned. To the extent that there was a curse on reprinting, and the Maggid told the Beis Yosef negative things about it. This is a very strange reason, in my opinion. First of all, if one shows a strong influence of the Sefer Malmud HaTalmidim on Rabbeinu Yeruchim throughout the work, maybe. But there's only one connection as so far, one parallel idea from the banned work, Malmud HaTalmidim. To say this curse is all because of that is strange. But even more so, I'll mention shortly that Avraham, a Talmud of the Torah, mentions Malmud HaTalmidim numerous times by name, and we never see anyone coming out against this work. Rather, it's used by all the Pesachim. So in the end, it's unclear why there's a curse on Rabbeinu Yeruchim. As far as the controversy of philosophy is concerned, I would like just to mention one more point. In 1306, shortly after the ban, the Jews were exiled from Provence. Yes, the Beis Yosef does use Rabbeinu Yeruchim, and that is part of the mystery. I don't know the answer to that. As far as the controversy of philosophy is concerned, I would just like to mention one more point. In 1306, shortly after the ban, the Jews were exiled from Provence. Many went to live in Spain. Now, although there was a ban, which we just learned about, that the Gedolim made about learning philosophy and everything, history shows, according to many, that philosophy became very popular, to the extent that many blamed the Geirish Svarad on it. Just to quote two of the many sources on the topic, the Chassid Yavetz, who was alive in Spain at the time of the Geirish, writes, Migolas Svarad ani asher garsheni vavaneseinu harabim vatsumim ukamat kulam hamir biyoymar ach loy rak mis falsim fim hamir kiyim af Rabbim benachmadim Yerushalayim, mi hayu English amdu b'mecharam, v'shamarat al das alayseyam, hanashim v'am hayaretz. Basically, he writes that when the time came, push came to shove, and they were given a choice to convert the philosophers. Unfortunately, many of them converted. Even people that he thought were Yerushalayim. The people that did not convert were people that were just the simple folk that did not know philosophy. So this is used till today in many different texts of different Gedolim to prove that how evil philosophy is. Now what's interesting is that most of the controversy documents, most of the people, even the Rajbas who showed used philosophy, even Rabbi Abu Mari, they all used philosophy. The question was just, and at least that point to what we're showing, the concern was that the masses shouldn't learn it openly or until the age of 25, but after that, one is allowed to learn philosophy. But from this Chassid Yavetz and onwards, there's been a very big, in many different circles, very strongly not to learn philosophy. And this is used as an example because of what happened. And as I said, it's one of the Chassid Yavetz. Many people that lived in the Geirish Svarad reference this, say the same testimony, so we have many verifications to say this. One other point is Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who is famous for always having sharp twists and different things about topics. He has a whole chapter where he's talking in the Yaakov Emden Motor Siddur, which everyone knows about, very famous. And over the years, after he printed his Siddur, he added in many different points to the Siddur. The Siddur was printed many times, different things were added into the Siddur, a lot has been written about it that they're not from him. However, he himself did add in a lot into his Siddur. What happened was that a few years ago, an excellent edition was printed where all the additions that Rabbi Yaakov Emden added in over the years was added in, and B, the stuff that were not from him that was added in over the years was put into a different font, so one is able to easily identify what is what. In a section which he has on about Tisha B'Av, he's talking about the reasons for the Churban over the generations. He has a section where he talks about philosophy he gets into and other averus that people are going on and on about, and he curses out the learning of philosophy. And then he writes, "Busha akar v'hishmet she'eris Yisrael mikol eretz Tzarfat." ובייחוד ממחוז פרוונציה שעלוב הסמאמר הרז'בה וסייאטה הקדישה והחרימו כל הלמד חכמס חיצוינס וכל אוס חכם אפילו על תנאי בה ונשאר פרסס רגל מהם וכל איס המדינה הדינה אשר היא בלשם אותי לבמי לגדל על יין המאי כמו איש הקוסף ואיגרס הסנצלס לברדאצ'י המודפס בתשובס הרז'בה אמר לו וזבוינן I'm going to translate it one second. So I say Chacham beinav hitris neged Harav Agadol. The Rajva shall yikma yachar b'dayim avim shall Yisrael. Vafalasav halaz im kol hachanasav elav v'arayis of yiris al panav k'may shenir me'is igris b'flaga b'dayil v'atzum loyid loyner k'mayim loyila michal makam herba kaiishi arfai azusai v'chatzipusai b'li lahavi tzavarai ba'ol gzeiris bezin Hagadol shall Yisrael. In short, first of all, the Rabbi Yaakov Emden's writing that they left Provence, which was at that time was a leading place for Torah. We have unbelievable amounts of Torah was being learned. We have many Gedolim that were alive in that period of time that were all active over there. He says that basically in 1306 he blames that part of the Gezeirah that happened was because they did not listen to the Rajba. Now, what's interesting is he's claiming that the Rajba is answering all learning Chachmas Chitzonis. The Rajba is not saying that. The Rajba only says, as we saw, until the age of 25. After the age of 25, he's permitting it. Now, another thing is very interesting, which is Rabbi Yaakov Emden also. He writes that this Rabbi Didya Pnimi, he spoke very proper to the Rajba, but then he says he didn't. He's starting up a fire. But anyway, it's not so clear what he's being very sharp, but it's not exactly clear if it's historically 100% as he's portraying it. But what is clear, and he does say this also, that this was the cause of the Geirish Svarad, which is similar to what his name, the other Chassidyavits, which many confuse, was written a few hundred years before. This is the first part. One second. He also blames because of philosophy that there were other Xerius on Klal Yisrael, such as in Ukraine and Poland, because the philosophy was very popular there also, but that's not this discussion. This is how the Siddur looks. Let me see if I can get it in front of the thing. It's printed by Eshkol. Okay. For the remaining time left, I would like to focus a bit on the actual Sefer, Malmud HaTalmidim. This Sefer in its time was extremely popular, as we've seen. It was the first Sefer of its kind, which is Drushus in the order of the Parsha. After that, there were many Svarim written that were written in the forms of Drushus, but he was the first. Mark Saperstein points out, based on manuscripts of the Sefer, it's not necessarily that each one of these pieces were a Drusha that he actually said. Some were. You read the Hagdama and you read different pieces, you see that they were drushes that he said at specific occasions, but not everything was. I mean to say, it's not an exact transcript of a text of what he said. He definitely added a lot to it, and some of it he probably never said in public. The Sefer remained very popular for a few hundred years. It was quoted by various famous Rishonim, such as the Meiri, who is, as we mentioned, Chaylik, he argued on the Rashba about the Chayim in general. The Ritva, who was, interestingly enough, from the same, pretty much, base medrash as the Rashba. Rabbi Shua ben Shua, the Talmud of the Rashba. The Archas Chayim, in both of his works, Archas Chayim and Kolbay, it's a different story. Emmanuel Haraimi, and others. Yosef Tapach printed a manuscript of an allegorical work in Taimon, in the 16th century, where in the middle of the work, the author writes, he's saying a certain idea, and then he says, "V'alo yadatem shabal sefer drash hamalami," and then he goes, "V'adrash hazem matzi etzleinu b'taimon karv l'meya ha'atakas," that there's over 100 different copies floating around in Taimon, a manuscript. You have to understand, this is all before the printed, in Taimon at least, they did not have the printing press, the possibly now. After the 16th century, Zev Gris points out, in his critical review of Mark Safferstein's book, that there's no real mention of this. This is true for many other Sfarim. Then the time they were very famous and widespread, but afterwards they lose popularity. I don't know if that's the reason. I think it's more they just were not printed. One famous example is the Drushas of Yeshua ben Shrub, which was written a little after Mamre Talmidim. In manuscripts, we have many different manuscripts. We could see that it was very famous, even as far as late as the Ramah, and even a little afterwards, we see it quoted in many places. As a matter of fact, it's very famous for being the earliest source that we have on sleeping on Shoshana. That's why people heard of it. But other than that, it's not known for a few hundred years until recently, past 20 years. Actually, about 40 years ago, it was reprinted in a facsimile edition, but it was very expensive, so not too many people had it. But after that, recently, a poor edition was printed, at least in black, in nice letters, but the rest of the job is horrible, was reprinted. Anyway, back to the Malmud Talmidim, the Shem HaGdolim, the Chidah, right, that he saw the Sefer Malmud manuscript. In 1866, the Mekitzin Nedamim Society printed it. This Mekitzin Nedamim Society was a society set up by mostly, I guess you could call them Askilim, but some Rabbanim were involved with them also. They printed many different manuscripts. There's a beautiful catalog of what they printed. They still exist till today. They print one or two books a year. And they printed the book in 1866 from a manuscript, a very, very nice edition. It included a beautiful haskama from Rav Shlomo Kluger, saying that he knows this work, and this work is mentioned by David Raham and others, as we'll see shortly. Today it's available, after that it was reprinted once in 1968 in Yerushalayim. To get a hard copy of an original 1968 edition or 1866 is pretty hard, but to get some copy is very easy, thanks to Hebrew books or Google books. Sefer is very uncommon and unknown in the Torah world. But a quick search on various search engines shows that some great Bekiim used it after 1866. In the academic world, it has received little attention. Only in the works on drushes by Betan, Rabbi Glicksberg, and most recently Mark Safferstein in his book and various articles, has dealt with some aspects of this work. In 1974, Rabbi Gordon wrote in YU an excellent doctorate on the Sefer, going through many different topics very clearly. Does a beautiful job. Recently, this parts of the Sefer has been dealt with in a doctorate in Israel about the Mabel in different early Parshanut. And in Italy, I see that there is also work being done on it, but I don't understand the Italians. I can't really tell you much about that. There are many manuscripts of this work until today, and a critical edition of this Sefer hopefully will be done in the future. One rather famous idea in the Sefer, which he repeats a few times, which most are not aware that he's the earliest source for it, but most are aware of this reason, for this is, why are women potter or not obligated in mitzvah saseishas nangram. It's a very famous reason, and that is, he writes, Adsha Taira Asha Kol Nasi Reser Shalom Hekila Ol Mitzvah saseishas nangrama Me Alva Isha. The Taira, which we know, makes life easy, mitzvah saseishas nangrama on the women. If she was busy with it, at the same time the man is, she would not have time. Okay, she used the words, there'll be a fight. The way it's always explained is, he would want to go to shul, she would want to go to shul. Who's going to deal with the kids? Now, he is the earliest source. There are other sources around his time that say it, but it's brought down Rav Jaham from him. But he's probably the earliest source that says this idea. Based on this idea, some have gone so far as to suggest that there's a famous Ramban. Where does he say? He says this three different places in his work. I have to give you the references afterwards. The Ramban who says that counting Sfiris Omer is not a mitzvah saseishas mangram. Everyone asks on Ramban, what do you mean? Of course, Sfiris Omer is a mitzvah saseishas mangram. Some have gone to suggest that the Ramban is a printing mistake, the famous old story of printing mistakes, but we have today a Talmud of the Ramban, or a Talmud of a Talmud of the Ramban, where he already says that the Ramban says such a thing. It's pretty far-fetched to say already at that time there's a printing mistake, and he even has an explanation, which is for a different story, a different time. But they say the whole reason why they're not obligating these mitzvahs, as we just learned from the Mamma Talmidim and many others, is because it takes time away from the other jobs. But the mitzvah of saying Sfiris Omer just takes a few seconds, so they're obligated to say it. This is what some people want to say, this is a big finish, different time to go into. As mentioned before, Ventulli had a very close relationship with Michael Scott. He quotes him over 20 times throughout his work. He writes he did not want to take credit for ideas which were not his, and he held one is supposed to say Davar B'Shem Amr. He writes that even though he was not Jewish, we find that Moshe brought the advice of Yisro in the Torah, and that was to teach us this. And he writes elsewhere, Sheroi l'kabal emes v'ayoshu mikol adam gam ki yiyo ha'ish ha'magid be'emes pachos me'am l'kabal gam yiyo me'am acher v'roi l'ish ha'hu ha'makabal dvar she'yem ra'isim b'shmoy v'michtivenu. What does this mean? We see from here, you have to accept the truth from anyone. Even if he's not as good as you, even if he's not Jewish, you have to quote it in the person's name, and you should just judge the statement, not the person who said it. This is a very large topic to go into. Just to mention one point, although the Sefer Mamon Talmidim was heavily influenced by the Rambam, in this instance he was not. As the Rambam at the beginning of his Shmoneh Parakim writes a little differently. Ra'isi lahagdim, he writes, just so you should know a little bit about my work, da, ki advar masher oimar yisam ve'ilah parakim, that I'm writing in these Shmoneh Parakim, u'bameshi yavim in a perish, and I'm writing the perish, which is the perish on others, ena yin yonim she'chidashtem ani me'atzim, are not ideas that I came up with myself, v'loi perushim she'badati, they're not perushim that I came up with myself, alehin yin yonim melukutim medivre chachamim, I got them from chacham. Umedivrei haphilosophim gamkein, and also from philosophers, hakadunim vachadashim, ancient and recent. Umechiburei harb bnei adam, v'shama ha'emes mimisha amar. Listen to the emes from whoever says it. The efshesh avim upon them. There are times that I'll bring memor shleimashi lashon sefer meforsim. That's from a famous sefer. Vein b'chol zera, vein misvar by masha amru b'misha kadam. I'm not taking glory for what someone else said. L'vishani tzar ha'gayit, I'm admitting it now. Ach b'shalay eskra, Amr pleini, I'm not saying every name. Shazu ha'richo, saying terozbal, that's one reason. It's going to take too much time. V'ef shulafamu, sheshema isha hu yachnes b'leiv, mishen tfunaboy, shazer hadar nifsa. And I don't want people to, you know, they're going to say, oh, I don't like that person, and they're not going to focus on the idea. V'yesh b'ktoif ra shalay yadeu, it's better. Nezer isha shalay liskar ha'imra ha'yil v'kavanasi shatusik ha'toyos l'kayra. I'd rather you just get the idea. I used to have a Rebbe that in yeshiva, the way it works is that certain achrayim that you learn in yeshiva are very hard to understand. So people would have a panic if they would hear that the Rebbe is about to say an idea from this complicated achrayim, so they would like zone out, so to speak. So the Rebbe had an idea, he used to just say the idea himself. And after he said, okay, everyone understands? Everyone would say, yeah. Okay. Then he would say, it was written by this and this person, and then he left. Anyway, others have taken the approach of the Rambam. Just to list one nice example, in the Journal of Hamayan, a few years ago, there was an article from Yoel Katan. He noticed, while learning through Reb Dessler's Michtav Melio, that there were many similarities to ideas in Dale Carnegie's work, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Some ideas were almost word for word. Investigating further, he discovered that Reb Dessler, who read English, did indeed use Dale Carnegie's work, but not in the original, but rather excerpts that were printed in the Reader's Digest. However, all the studies that I've mentioned that were written, including the excellent doctor of Rabbi Gordon, I have not focused much on the Minhagim and Halachas and pictures of the author's time that emerges from a careful reading of the Sefer. Just to cite a few samples of this. There's a very known and accepted minhag by most Jews they have no problem to accept this minhag, which is the Milchiks on Shavuos. In the Sefer Minhag HaVeseinu Biyadeinu, Rabbi Oberlander has a very nice chapter on the topic, showing its earliest sources. However, he was not aware that there's an earlier source. The Malmud, the Talmidim, brings down that they used to eat Milchiks on Shavuos. Another example of a minhag that's not discussed by too many people from the Malmud Talmidim is there's a famous topic known as the Machnisei Rachamim controversy. It plays a role in many areas of tefillah and halacha regarding certain tefillahs which appear like we're saying them to Malachim and not Hashem. Much has been written about this topic. Some say that that's why, according to some, the Gra did not say Brachuni L'Shalem and Shalom Aleichem on Friday night. An excellent write-up on this topic was done by Dr. Shlomo Sprecher in Yeshurim Volume 3, and he does quote the Malmud Talmidim. But the Malmud Talmidim, what does he write on this topic? He writes, Leimatzina betfilas Moshe Rabbeinu veloy betfilas Shar Naviim veloy beseder Anshei Knesset Gedolah Zecher rak Lashem Levadei Yisrael. We don't find such a thing. But as I mentioned, it's a very big debate in Rishonim, and that's his opinion. One last point I would like to make, although this work was written in Italy, and he quotes his Christian friend Michael Scott over 20 times, Mark Saperstein points out that there are many references, some open, some not, against Christianity. One example is when he's talking about Puravu, he writes, oh, that's a very important mitzvah to have children, as opposed to the Christians that they hold off one of their kids that the kids should not get married. There's another thing that also has to do a little bit with Christianity and a little bit with halacha and minig, which is as follows. There's a minig brought down, which is that before you go into shul, you should make sure your shoes are not dirty. In other places, there was even a mat before you walked into shul that you wiped your feet. Other places had a mat that you took off your shoes. This minhag as a whole was recently, there was a beautiful write-up in the Sefer from my friend Rabbi Chil Goldover called Minhagei HaKehilos. And in the Sefer he has a whole write-up tracing between Rishonim, Achronim, the development all over the world, what they did, different aspects of this minhag. In the Sefer Kaftav HaTarach, which is a famous Rishon, he writes about talking about the minhag of taking off your shoes before you get off. Before you go into the Pesach Masses, he says, "Mizeh Yerush Minhagim." He brings down that they had such a minig. Shemenhagim Hagi Keminig Aratzis Halalu Shemenicham Naliyim Repenta Pesach Masses Bechutz Veloy Keminig Haloyazim. Now the question is, where did this minig come from? A lot of people will say, yeah, you know, Arabs, they do it. So in Arab countries, you'll find sources that say you should take it. So basically, the Jews got it from the Arabs. Others say, no, we have much more early sources than that. So the question is where this minhag exactly came from. There's a Sefer, Mishnas Chacham. Mishnas Chacham was written by Rav Moshe Chagiz. Rav Moshe Chagiz was a famous person. He's a little older than Rabbi Yaakov Emden. For a large period of time, for most of his life, he was on good terms with Yaakov Emden. At some points, he wasn't. It's a beautiful book written on it by Professor Elisheva Kalbach. And many articles have been written about him by Meir Ben-Eyal in some of the early issues of Ali Sefer. Now, he wrote a bunch of svarim. One of his svarim is called Mishnas Chacham on Avos. It's full of fascinatingly interesting things. It's on Perek Vav of Avos, or whatever the Brisa of Avos. The Memchas Dvarim Shetayr Niknes. He does not deal with all 48, but he deals with about 24. Recently filled on, printed in a fancy edition, this sefer. In this sefer, he talks about this custom of taking off shoes before you get an aliyah, which there's also sources to do. And then he talks about before you go to shul. He says then he writes, "V'yesh darshin ha'isim l'gnai, ki kacha yiminim ha'shma'ilim." That we got it from the Arabs. "V'ani darish ha'isim ha'shvach, the kol zman she'yisrol heim ha'uma ha'nevcheres, chi kanduma l'kol eile ha'umais. Im ken kol dar ha'toy v'animtza b'in nehem ene ele gono v'atzleinu me'yitaini." They took it from us. "V'leicha lila she'im lamdo ha'isanu v'esfil l'hanag ha'isam minim ha'toyf." Dim to chapes timzak. He called him Yisrael Tairi. Kimoish pesafti b'mayim menhagim. He has the same. He was actually working on a whole thing about menhagim. Only part of it was printed, which is to discuss various sources of menhagim. So basically, what he says is that even though you find that Arabs did it, we did it before them. They got it from us. That's Ramosha Chagiz's opinion. In a sefer called Mazne Tzedek, written by Dov Berish Turish, printed in the 1880s, I believe, something like that, he brings down this Ramosha Chagiz, and he says he doesn't understand what's the problem. The Chazal got it from the Romans. And he says he doesn't know what the whole big deal, if you say that they did take it from the Arabs, they didn't. We find that there's a famous Gemara, "Amale loy nitna tayra hayina lamid loyimdim sniyas mechatul the gezel ming amala varayis miyayna deracharetz mitarnagol." Famous Gemara, who knows, "Vehem nivra kaidim shnivra adem. Am yigzar oimer ki amin hagam atayim asherim bein hachatulim hamagulim bein hamimalim ashefelim." And all these things, "Heim ganvu mide seim eishar mei am yishurim v'loy mitana teitzik tayru." He does not like this reason of Mazmur Tzedek. He doesn't know why he makes such a big deal. He doesn't have a problem if it actually did come from Arabs. The question is, in a way, you could point out that it would have a halachic nafkamina. How gets the mamma tell me the mamma in short second, but it could have a halachic nafkamina if it did come from the Goyim or not. And that is as follows. Everyone knows there's a famous minig, again on Shavuos, of putting up flowers and trees in the base medrash, in the house, and everything. The question is asked where it comes from. So again, there's many articles written about it showing early sources for it. And again, as the same as before, Rabbi Oberlander, Minhag HaSeinu B'Yadeinu, has a clear article on the topic where he discusses it. Now, his famous gra that the Vilna Gaon was very anti the custom of doing it. Why? He says, "So chukasei ma'aseh leichu." What does it mean, "the chukasei ma'aseh leichu"? It means is that the Gaon did it. The question is, if the Gaon did it, so where did we get it from? So if we got it from the Gaon, so all these sources go out the window. But the question is, what does it mean that the Gaon did it? We have to check into. Did the Gaon do it? Did we do it before the Gaon? And that's what I'm saying over here. The same thing with Ramesh Chagiz. Ramesh Chagiz is pointing out that he's saying that we did not get it. Whereas the Mazne Tzedek is saying, yeah, we did get it from them. And it's not a big deal. Even if we did get it from them, we could get it from them. Now, there is a differentiation in the discussion by the flowers on Shavuos, that some say that it makes a difference where it was done. If it was done as part of the Avodah Zarah, or if it was done just to decorate. Whatever, that's a different story. Anyway, but the Malman Talmidim also talks about this Chalitza is not lion, and this source is pretty much noted by Rabbi Goldover in the Sefer Minhag HaKeilos, except he misses a few words. Not that it makes such a big difference, just one little point. He brings down this whole thing about that you have to clean your feet, and you have to take off the shoes, and everything, and then he says, then he writes, "The kafir inin hazeh ba iser nila sandal b'yom hakipurim shetzricha bar sus mekiyah v'kol kedei lahayir ha'adam al darkei tshuva." The reason why we don't wear shoes on Yom Kippur is, and we wear white clothes, is today for parts of tshuva that humbles the person. And the umays that are copy us, they also wear, I guess on day fast, which is out of my, not familiar so much about it, but in Christianity it seems when they fast they have this thing, they do take off their shoes and wear white clothes, they got it from us. So here we see that he at least feels that some aspect of this, of some aspect of the taking off the shoes, at least in some part of the time, the Christians at least got from us. But that does not have, that does not deal with the Arabs. But again, in the, as I said, Moshe Chagiz is of the opinion that the Arabs got it from us. Now the truth is that I'm not sure why. I think he's 100% right, because in the base of most of tefillah has to do with areas of most areas of tefillah is learned down from Beis Hamikdash. In Beis Hamikdash, they did not walk around with shoes and stuff, so it seems that it's already before the Arabs. But then again, that's what the Maven Tzedek says, maybe it is from the Romans, but I don't really buy into that. But anyway, that's the story, and that's it for right now. Until next week.